please welcome Julian Vogels and give him a warm applause.
Thanks.
Sorry, I made a terrible mistake. 8011. Der Talk wird nicht auf 8012, sondern auf der 8011 zu hören sein. Please.
Thanks for the introduction. I'm really happy to be here. I'm very excited, actually. Maybe a little bit too excited, so please bear with me. Today, I talk about the evolution and design of digital musical instruments. The talk will be not so technical, but like the purpose is actually more to inspire makers to like pursue this field and join me in my passions for these instruments because they're amazing. So, just really briefly about me. I'm Julian. I'm from Southern Germany. I studied in what you just said in Quebec, music technology, and right now I'm running a little music tech startup company in Hong Kong as the CTO, and I'm a drummer. So first of all, where do DMIs, digital musical instruments, come from? They actually have a really long history, despite what you might think. Acoustical musical instruments like the piano, the violin, they're centuries old and they were refined and they're really very good instruments. But at the verge of the 20th century, people discovered new technologies and they wanted to utilize this in the context of music. So already 1897, there was the telharmonium built, which was kind of like a huge organ kind of thing. And the idea was there was no radio, so they wanted to distribute the sound to the living rooms of the people. So it was like a huge cable thing, it weighed like 200 tons, it's amazing. And that was the first one that someone spent his whole fortune on. Then the first, what we call open air controller, because you don't touch anything, is built by Leon Theremin, or Lev Theremin, his real name. And excuse me, I think there's no sound coming out of my laptop. So this is how a theremin sounds. You might know it from the X-Files, for example. Was it used? Then, in 1928, Monsieur Martineau built the Onde Martineau, which had like a very unique control. You see this ring, which was like on a slide, so you could like have like super nice tremolo effects and a very slight control of dynamics. So this sounds like this, and Radiohead actually also rebuilt one recently and use it in a lot of songs because it's really an amazing instrument. So all those early music instruments, they enjoyed a lot of approval by the society just because it was a very futurist time. Same also is valid for the tritonium, which is a predecessor of the synthesizer and had like a resisting wire where you play. It sounds like this. Then later the Hammond organ was invented. Doesn't really classify as an electronic instrument because it's actually electromechanic, but it is a such important invention that I just wanted to show it because it was very beneficial to the whole field. Then later, the electronic sackbut was invented, which was the first instrument which was like a synthesizer that was voltage controlled and had like extreme precise control or accurate control of timbral properties of the sound. It sounded like this. Then a new age commences, which is computer music. So in 57, Max Matthews at Bell Labs used the telephone network and the computers that the facilities that they had to actually build the first computer program for sound synthesis. And at the same time, also the Mark II from RCA was published or invented. So it sounds like this is one of the first programmed synthesizers. Then very popular, Moog, invented the Moog and the Mini Moog, which until today super famous for their fat sound and were very like a huge commercial success. Then another new age, everything became digitalized. So the Fairlight was one of the first digital synthesizers, and the MIDI was invented or specified as a specification. So you could actually now connect synthesizers to another to use. Actually, this is very important because now the interface was separated from the sound source. Now you could just send control signals, which is very important. We will see in a minute. And also, 1980 was like the first like popular, let's say, unconventional controllers that like get away from the whole keyboard thing. And a lot of, at the same time, a lot of like research institutions were founded in like Steim, IEM, IRCAM, and so on. The CMI Fairlight, CMI sounds like this. Or digital synthesizer. Then, still in the 80s, of course, as you probably all know, this sound is the popularization and of synthesizers, which were so commonly used until today in popular music. And one of the cornerstones of that was the DX7 from Yamaha, which was the first one that used FM digital synthesis. And also in the mid-80s, Miller Pocket invented Max. Max is until today used as somehow like the most important or one of the most important like computer music softwares for composing, but also sound synthesis and mappings. So it's like a visual programming IDE. And out of this, also Pure Data was coming out of this same invention. And then controllers get more and more unconventional. So, for example, Max Matthews, the same guy who invented computer music at Bell, he developed the Radio Baton. Then there were controllers with like more advanced sensors. And for example, there's also the Lightning, which used infrared and sounds very different. Like now it's more like a digitalized analog, like conventional instrument, but very different playing techniques. And in 2002, the NIME conference was the first NIME conference, which is until today the biggest conference for new musical interfaces and digital music instruments. And between 2002 and 2008, there were 266 musical instruments presented. And I don't have data for 2002 to 2008 until today, but there you can see how many new inventions there are and how popular this field became. In the future, I think it will be even like we have an increasing number of new inventions and great new instruments because we have more accessible sensors and materials and also I think the community of musicians, which tend to be a little conservative and not very keen on trying new instruments, they kind of open up a little bit. You see more and more like new instruments being played by musicians, professional musicians. Yeah, but at the same time, so I reviewed a lot of patents in this field, and unfortunately, there are so many inventions, but like they're not really known. They're not really a big commercial or even like just normal like public success. And that's also why I'm giving my talk. I want to inspire more people to build them in a way that they don't like stay in a garage. So now, to the design part. A DMI is composed of three parts. So you got the interface, where the musician interacts with the instrument, but This distinction is very important that you have the interface that is separated from the sound source. So the sound source is normally a computer. And the mapping maps this input parameters to the output parameters, so synthesis parameters. So that's pretty amazing because now DMIs are flexible. You can customize them. You have completely, it's completely open. You can do whatever sound you want with them, and you can tweak the controls beyond what is just a physical object that is like, well, you have to rebuild a new one. You can just like, it's so fast to get to a nice musical expression. So in my personal research and work, I focus more on the gestural control side, so less on the synthesis side. Because I find that controllers are really very interesting. We use them all the time. For example, you know, you use a keyboard to type. It's specifically designed for this purpose. You use a gamepad to game. But sometimes you even use a keyboard for gaming or a gamepad because you have to write on your console. And so they see that they have to be really, for one purpose, designed for this thing. And that's for every instrument, it's the same. And there are different types of them. So I find this very interesting to classify them like this. So you have augmented music instruments, you have instrument-like DMIs, instrument-inspired DMIs, and alternate controllers. For example, here. Augmented musical instruments are real instruments where you stick a bunch of sensors to them. For example, touch buttons or FSRs or whatever you can imagine, actually. Here you see also like in Neil Falwell's adapted trombone, it's like a distance measurement with ultrasound. And all those things are then mapped to synthesis that runs like in parallel to the actual instrument's output. Then a more commercial type of this, of instruments, are instrument-like controllers, because they kind of, they try to emulate the musician's gesture of a known instrument perfectly. So like, imagine like your trumpeter? I don't know. You get this instrument, and you can immediately use it because it has the exact same gestures, but the sound can be different. Then there are instrument-inspired controllers, where it's a little further from the instrument-like controllers. You can still use some of your gestures that you were used to as a musician, but it makes more out of them. Like you can, for example, here's the pretty new instrument, the Seaboard Grand, the one with the wobbly texture there. And it's like a piano, but you can press down, and it has like a subtle control of vibrato, and you can slide pitch. There's also the Eigenharp, which is on the top right, and the instrument one, which was a recent, very new instruments. And an alternate controller has nothing to do actually with any musical instrument that was there before. For example, there's the audio cubes, which are actually cubes that know about each other's position and rotation. So you can actually imagine, like, it's not like the conventional musical instruments. It's more like for sequential control of things. Or like, it's called an ambient instrument. Then, for example, Perry Cook, he's a famous instrument maker. So he used everyday objects, like a mug or a shoe, because he said people can relate to that so immediately that they just pick it up and they know how to hold it. And if I place the sensors at the right spot, they know how to use it way faster than if it's just an arbitrary object. There's also the alpha sphere, which is also a very interesting shape and light. And also, like the, for example, a graphic tablet. I like this as an example because it has pretty accurate sensors and pretty. It's also an everyday object. Like you know how to use a pen, and you're very skilled already at it. So why not use it as an instrument? Then this is also part of the alternate controllers, collaborative controllers. At the right, you see the Tuca, where two people play at the same time, and the React table on the left from Sergi Yoda, where it's a tangible interface. You interact with the digital digital information on the physical space. It's all projected from the bottom, and it reads whatever objects you place on them, and you can rotate them and change the distances between them and make music like this. Then there are body controllers, which are very popular at the moment too. It's just, well, you want to use your body gestures, whatever gesture you want to, like, you want to just acquire all data about your hand movement or body movement. So, for example, there's Michel Weisswitz. He has, it's called The Hands, it's a very famous one. And Imogen Heave, for example, she developed the gloves in the middle. On the right, there's Onyx Ashanti with Beat Jazz. And on the bottom is Marco Donnarumma, who uses biosignals from his arms directly to make music. And also open air controllers. Open air controllers are, you don't have any feedback, anything. It's just like your hands, you don't have any sensors. So they use always computer vision for this. And yeah, and for this in the future, we can all imagine where the journey goes to augmented reality and totally immersive systems. So, to the interface part. How do you design an interface? How do you start doing this? So, for me, what I like to do is I think about gesture, about how does a musician move? What movements could you do, or what can you imagine would correspond well to dynamics, so to volume, and to pitch? Would it be discrete? Would it be a sliding pitch? And what corresponds to timbre of the music? So timbre, I'm not sure if everyone knows the term. It's about if the sound is more sharp or more mellow, or you know. Then to get an idea of what you could do, the first thing you do is you observe musicians how they play. So then you know because that's where they're coming from, and there are a lot of interesting gestures in all musical instruments. For me, for example, I did a study where I studied the gestures of harmonica players. And they have a lot of interesting gestures, like the hand cupping gesture, or just how they move the instrument. And they have different techniques with their fingers and also like angles. And so I did a whole motion capture study, which is amazing to get lots of data and numerical data. There are optical ones, there are exoskeleton ones, and also magnetic field motion capture. The problem is that they're super expensive and you only find them in like research facilities. So what would be better for the DIY maker is you use videos. You just look at musicians perform and use open source software. My favorite is Elan. And you just annotate the gestures that they make. Like you say, okay, it's like huge upward movement and all these things, you annotate them, and then you also listen to the sound, or you can even analyze the sound and export it as different sound properties. For example, the Sonic Visualizer, I didn't put it on there, but it's a great software for analyzing sound. And then you compare what property of the sound changed when a musician did this gesture. For example, for harmonica, it was like many people leaned backwards when they were more expressive and more high pitched. And those things you can use them. They already used it to those gestures. Annotation software works pretty simple. You just like you have different videos. For example, on what I labeled with 3 there is just some data, some spectrocentroid, I think, and then you just say okay, what happens, and then you look at the graph and you know what sound property is affected, and then you can use that in your considerations what gesture you want to use. For the acquisition of gesture, of course, I could elaborate on that, but I wanted to keep it short. You use all kinds of different sensors. They have to be suitable to what you want to acquire. For example, FSRs for force, sliders and LVDTs for displacement, infrared and ultrasound, you can use them as displacement or general, like if there's a hand here or there or whatever. So be creative. If you want to look more into sensors and stuff, you can also use sensor fusion to get even more data out of two different, like if you have two sensors and you use sensor fusion, you can get more information out of it, then you could use that you can get from with either one of them or both together. Now, the second part is the mapping part, which is kind of like distinguishing a bad instrument from a good instrument. Because you can have very easy mappings, like one-to-one, like, you know, you do this, pitch goes up, pitch goes down, or volume up, volume down, whatever. And but it turns out a lot of good music instruments are not that simple, because that, of course, you understand it really quickly, but it gets boring, and then your instrument has some kind of like a toy-like character, which you want to avoid. You want to make it a little bit more complex because you want people to be able to master your instrument, and it shouldn't be easy. A many-to-many mapping, for example, is you use multiple input variables and you map them to multiple synthesis parameters. So a musician doesn't, like, you can try out some stuff, but you wouldn't really get what's really going on because you have to change all of them at the same time to get to a result. That inspires a more like holistic kind of use of the instrument. So the musician more or less just learns gestures instead of learns parameters, which is like a totally different paradigm of using instruments. Interesting mapping ideas are also, you can use machine learning to classify a gesture. For example, you could record a gesture like this with any sensor you attach, or just using the instrument, you record a gesture. And then you use a classification algorithm to say, do you have three or four gestures, and you say which one was the closest, and then you trigger an action based on that. You can also use indirect data. Let's say you have you have a slider, and you can of course read where it is, but also you should think about, can I use the velocity of someone sliding the slider and map it to another synthesis parameter? Then also you can user-defined mappings, although you should be careful with this because it's more flexible, but then you lose kind of the face of your instrument because it was designed to sound like this, or not work like this, and if you make it totally random, then it's random. Then so you have a lot of cool open source mapping tools. Like LibMapper, where you can even map over a whole network using OSC, Open Sound Control. And also other interesting toolboxes from IRCAM, where you can, this is where you can do the whole gesture recording and classification. Then the sound synthesis. As I said, I'm not talking so much about this, but there's several different techniques, additive, subtractive, FM, you have cool physical modeling stuff where you actually emulate a real instrument just digitally, and you have a lot of great open source software to build your own. Then feedback. So if you're playing a violin, then you bow it and the whole body actually vibrates. Many musicians don't even recognize it, but it's very important for them when they're learning an instrument that they get the vibrations on their body. If you would take that away, it would be way harder for them to learn the instrument. It gives them a feedback about the state of the instrument. The problem is now, with digital music instruments, this doesn't occur naturally. So you would have to add actuators to the instrument to give some kind of primary feedback to the performer. You can do that with vibration motors, servos, whatever can convey information to haptics, visual, or even if there's a special sound that occurs. So so I want to inspire the whole Makey community to build digital music instruments. I think it's a very exciting field. It's complex enough so you can spend your whole life in this field, and you have a lot of tools at your hand. Everything is getting cheaper. The sensors are now really like. Those instruments they saw from the 80s, they were super expensive. Now, this is really doable. Then you have all those embedded systems like Raspberry Pi, BeagleBone Black, et cetera, where you can do now a synthesis on this space, on a credit card space, which is amazing for most people that built those other instruments 30 years ago. So the challenges, though, are there. So, for example, at the NIME conference, there are so many instruments, but a lot of them sound kind of the same because they have a crazy interface, they map it somehow, and then it's just noise. It's just like, and nobody can really relate to this other than people that really like noise music. And often, in my eyes, it's also an excuse like, oh yeah, I do noise music, so I don't have to care about the sound. So don't make this mistakes, and also don't be the only one who masters your instrument. That's one something that I did in the past. I built instruments, and I tried to be good at it, but actually what I should have done is give it out, make two or three of them, and give them to musicians, and have their feedback immediately. And that's also why you have to make the setup easy. For example, an audience doesn't like it if everything is cabled, and you're actually more on your Mac than on your instrument. So make it. That's also like, you know, the coolest thing is to have it like an embedded system, a box, like an instrument, what people are used to. Because it's very important that a musician can talk to the audience, that the audience sees like big gestures and can relate to what the musician is doing. If they don't even see what you're doing on the keyboard, then they won't find the performance interesting. It's not only about the music; it's also about the visuals. A nice quote that I wanted to bring is this. So this is Wes and Ryder talking about DMIs and what the perfect DMI would look like. And it has a low entry fee. Everyone can pick it up and immediately make sound with it without knowing much about it. But it has no ceiling on virtuosity. It means that anyone who wants to master it has to spend 10,000 hours to be perfect at it, just like with the violin or the piano. Here are some of my own creations. On the left top is what I call Philumis. It's a rubber cord on a sound body and then a joystick on the top, so you can plug the string and then modulate the sound in two dimensions or even circular one. Then the Lura Box is a device where you press record and then use it as a tape player, and you can play your recording back and forth, and then you can destroy it with effects, and you destroy it every loop, you destroy it and destroy it until it's noise. So exactly what you shouldn't do, as I said. And so in the middle, this little thing is my first like commercial object. It's not really an instrument, it's a music accessory. It's a feedback device, so exactly for haptic feedback, you can use it as a metronome or etc. We're producing this now in China, too. So just a short demonstration of one of those. This is pretty freaky. Very, very experimental. And here is another one that is this one, an electronic harmonica. Okay, I think I just concluded like this. Thank you.
Wow. Hi, that's awesome.
What do you do?
We have, basically, we don't have any time anymore. We are 3 minutes late, but we are,
okay.
It's the last talk before the lunch break. So we have some time for Q&A. If there are some questions, please. There are the two microphones. Ask your questions.
Hi.
May you play again? May you play again your music? I think it's better than asking, answering questions.
I thought my talk. I knew my talk would last like a little bit more than a half hour, so I didn't want to do this as well. I can set it up in 10 minutes and it's ready, or you can come to the Void Village and then really try it out yourself later if you want. So. Yeah.
Please.
Did you ever try the brainwaves as a source of sound?
Yes, actually that's right. I left that out, but there was a famous musician and developer that used this brainwave to make music with like a huge helmet and stuff. Although I think it was very difficult because it's very noisy to actually think about music and then have it be music. I think we're still a little bit away from this stage, but there are people working on this, yes. I think even at the Seabase, as I heard.
I was thinking about something more earthly, like, I don't know, moving your arm and the brain lighting up in some zones.
Mm-hmm.
Did you try that?
Well, if you move your arm, you can also just measure the EMG signal that comes directly from your arm. And for example, there was a nice project in Montreal where there was one girl, Erin Guy, who she asked method actors to have like the arm pierced and like with a syringe in the arm, which is very painful. But she got the best signal out of the arm, and then she asked them to act emotions and translated those emotions into music that was made by robots. So you can do a lot of stuff with EMG signals and...
Thanks.
Someone else? Go ahead.
Yeah, just a very meta question. What instruments do you have with you, like in the village? Like, what can you try out there, or?
The only one that's really set up is this one, the electronic harmonica. The other one, if someone is interested, this is also like the whole instruction on how to build this is on my website, so we can actually make it work. It's not working right now, but but we can make it work in a couple of hours, I guess.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, someone else? Good. Thank you, Julian, for
your
very interesting talk.